Good morning. Welcome to the Windows 32 Developers Conference. I think this is probably the biggest gathering of PC developers that there's ever been. In fact, we've overflowed the capacity of the Moscone Center. We have a second room upstairs where John Lazarus, Microsoft's VP of System Marketing, is. John, is your room ready?
Bill, we've got 1,500 to 2,000 people up here, and I think we can see you up here pretty well.
Great. Well, this conference is about the opportunity represented by Windows 32. Our industry has been characterized by a number of major opportunities that software companies seized and came out with products that went on to incredible success. Microsoft itself got started over 15 years ago by seeing the opportunity represented by microprocessor-based machines. The early machines were quite modest in their capabilities. Their memory size, their power was very limited. But we saw that an interpretive language as a standard across all of these machines could allow for software sharing. And so we created Microsoft Basic. It's very fascinating for me to see the role of interpretive languages now coming back into the mainstream, particularly as they're extended with object orientation. This Basic was handcrafted. We had to put it into 4K of code. And I knew every line by heart and supervised every change that was made. Well, that Basic fueled our growth and allowed us to develop literally dozens of products. This is a picture of the original Microsoft team. Looks a lot like the people here today. Maybe a little less polished, a little younger. But those were back in the days when you could actually have more products than you had developers. And products were very, very simple. Well, the next major opportunity that Microsoft saw was the move to 16-bit architectures. And so we talked with a lot of companies about building a 16-bit personal computer. And it was very exciting that one of the companies that was interested in that was IBM. Although they started out with a plan for an 8-bit machine, we convinced them to go with 16-bit, and the result was this original IBM PC. And many people thought that simply porting over existing software would be the main thing for this machine. And in fact, a number of those ported packages did quite well. But the big successes were the ones that were designed to take advantage of that machine from the beginning. Packages like Lotus's 1, 2, 3. There were three people in Microsoft who managed the IBM relationship. Myself, Steve Ballmer, and Bob O'Rear. And we were nervous about the whole thing. We weren't quite sure how to work with a company like that. In fact, when we flew down to meet with IBM for the first time, they told us they'd have 40 people in the room to talk to us and ask us a lot of questions. We got down to Florida and remembered that we hadn't brought any ties at all. So we stopped at a shopping center. Didn't open until exactly when we were supposed to be at our meeting, but we had decided it was probably better to have ties and be late than go in a normal way. And so this was the result. It was a fascinating combination, but never what you'd have to call a natural fit. Well, the vision that enables all of this, of course, is the incredible advance in semiconductor technology, most vividly represented by the rapid pace of microprocessor innovation. Going from the 8080, which was the processor in that original Altair computer, to today's mainstream processor, Intel's 486, we can see that there are over 200 times as many transistors, and that reflects itself in the performance of the machine. In fact, in this year alone, we've seen Intel come up with double-speed 486 machines, and they're already talking about bringing out, by the end of this year, their P5 chip that'll more than double the performance of the 486. So software developers have a lot of horsepower in these machines. And we really need to have a foundation that lets people get at all of that power. Of course, at the same time as the chip has been improving, software applications have been becoming more powerful, going from VisiCalc to 1-2-3, perhaps to today's Microsoft Excel. We can see the incredible proliferation of features and power with these packages. But in order to get personal computers out to more and more people, we can't just deliver power. We have to deliver ease of use. And Xerox's creation of machines based on graphical interface was an inspiration to everyone in the industry to take high-volume machines and provide those same type of capabilities. Microsoft stated a commitment to do that in late 1983, and it was about 2 years later that we shipped the first version of Microsoft Windows. Now, this is a product that did not catch on overnight. It required a lot of patience on our part to continue to invest and improve the product. And a number of companies bet with us by building applications from the very beginning. For example, Aldus with PageMaker, or Micrographics with their various graphics packages. And so the sales started to catch on, particularly as more powerful hardware was sold. We did a major improvement to this environment in 1987. For the first time, we shipped a version that was specific to the 386 and used its paging capability and virtual machine capability to provide a lot of flexibility for existing DOS users. At the same time that we were trying to bring Windows on top of DOS into the mainstream, we were trying to think through what should our high-end operating system strategy be. One of the things we did early on in our history was become an early commercial licensee of the Unix operating system. In fact, for all of the 1980s, we were the highest volume licensee of that system, working with companies like Santa Cruz Operation and creating products like Xenix on a number of platforms. Even so, the volume was very, very small, because this was a market that was quite fragmented. And so we didn't see that as our final solution for a high-end operating system. Of course, in probably what is one of the most famous failures of all time in software, we teamed up together with IBM to create the OS2 operating system. When I say failure, I don't mean that OS2 hasn't played an important role running on the server and running in some specialized applications. But I mean that certainly the view that we had that this would come into the mainstream turned out to be wrong. There were a number of flaws in the approach that we took. For example, the idea that the high volume system didn't allow an easy migration up to the high-end system. That was a significant problem. The graphics programming, the kernel programming were all dramatically different, requiring substantial changes to applications. In many ways, we didn't aim high enough. Designing OS2 to have 16-bit code and targeting the 286, that was a mistake. Perhaps most importantly, the vision of OS2 was driven by taking mainframe-type features as part of an overall SAA strategy and bringing those down onto the PC instead of addressing the unique needs in the PC environment. But we still saw a need for a high-end system. A lot of high-end hardware today runs on Unix, and Unix has also played a very substantial role, selling very well into a number of environments. Unfortunately, though, Unix is licensed in a very different way than Microsoft operating systems. When Microsoft licenses its operating systems to hardware manufacturers, we do that with a restriction that it cannot be modified. We believe that the benefit of having it be a solid base common for all applications justifies that restriction. Unix, on the other hand, has served as the basis for all of the major system vendors to do their own proprietary work. And in that way, we still see a lot of variety. Unix will continue to do very well in a number of markets, and so we see it as very important to connect to that environment and even provide some compatibility. But we do not see it as the foundation for a high-end operating system for mainstream applications. What we've decided to pursue is a single strategy, not a strategy split into low-end and high-end, but a single strategy focused on Windows, and focused more and more on the applications interface that you'll be hearing about during this 3-day conference, Windows 32. Part of the underpinning for this is the incredible success that Windows has had in the last couple of years. Starting in May 1990, with our release of version 3, along with the popularity of 386-based personal computers with VGA-type graphics, Windows started to move into the mainstream. And a very positive phenomenon developed, where the more Windows we sold, the more people developed applications. And the more applications that were developed, the more Windows we sold. This is the same positive momentum cycle that allowed DOS in the early 1980s to overtake 5 competitive operating systems and eventually go on to receive more than a 90% share of desktop computers. That is certainly repeating itself again today with the Windows environment. Windows 3.1, introduced this year, is off to an incredible start. We shipped 1 million copies in just the first week of having that product available. And not only do we see over 80% of our existing Windows users moving up to that, but we also see lots and lots of new users. In fact, our sales to new users have more than doubled since the introduction of Windows 3.1. A major element of this is working with hardware manufacturers to optimize their systems around Windows. We go to the chip makers, we go to the peripheral makers, and we talk through what kind of video and audio can make the best Windows system. We also have a new logo that you may have seen on a lot of systems, and you will be seeing it on more and more, and that's called Windows Ready to Run. It indicates that Windows has been installed on that system, and the hardware design has been optimized to make Windows run in a great way. Well, with the success of Windows in the mainstream, we looked at how other companies had met the challenge of having a family of products ranging from lower price to higher capability. And we saw that in the hardware industry, this had happened several times before. Most notably, IBM with its 360 strategy and DEC with its VAC strategy had defined a single architecture and yet had multiple implementations of that architecture. And by doing this, they allowed customers to leverage all the investments in that architecture across a wide range of machines. We're even starting to see that now in the PC industry. For example, if we look at NCR's product line, we can see at their low end, they're building smaller and smaller notebook machines that use handwriting-based input. And at the high end, they have systems with as many as 8 microprocessors that are available for high reliability, high performance server applications. Well, taking this as our inspiration, we decided to make Windows a scalable family. And when we say scalable, we mean across an increasing range of hardware products. Today, at the low end, we're working with people to put Windows into wallet-sized devices. We're working with people to put it into intelligent fax machines. And so you're going to see a proliferation of low-cost devices, some very portable, some connected to the TV, using Windows as a basis. Looking up towards the high end, we have a number of companies who are pushing Windows to the limit. Whether it's multiprocessor implementations or new chip architectures, there's very exciting work going on at the high end of this product line. So as we evolve into those different ends, we'll also continue to improve the Windows API, providing things like more multimedia support or voice input support, all the characteristics we feel that are important throughout this operating system family. And the result is leverage of developers' work and end-user learning through all of these products. Well, today is a major milestone in that scalable family strategy. Today, we're announcing the availability of the Microsoft Windows 32 Developer Kit. Everyone here today should have received this compact disc in your bag as you checked in. It's also available to people not at this conference. For people who want it with the documentation, it's $399. And for people who want the CD only, it's $69. We expect that over 10,000 copies of this development system will be sent out and used for initial development of Windows 32 applications. Now, I started this speech off talking about opportunity. And that's really what I think draws us all together. Whether it's corporate developers wanting to build great applications to make their company more competitive, or whether it's commercial developers who are selling several hundred thousand copies is much better than selling a few thousand copies, our goal with Windows is to give you major opportunities. Here we're seeing the sales of Windows-based applications. And you can see that it's gone up very, very dramatically. Already, over $2 billion of Windows software have been sold. And I expect us to more than double this in the years ahead. By having a platform out there that is on millions and millions of machines, we can enable lots of applications to be written that could never have been justified in the past. And we see ourselves not only drawing on the base of Windows applications and DOS applications, but also people who in the past have developed primarily for Macintosh or primarily for one of the versions of Unix, or people who have worked on mini computers and mainframes. We see bringing all of those development communities together and innovating to build a new class of applications that only the Windows platform could allow for. With that in mind, we beefed up very dramatically the effort we do to communicate with all developers. And part of that is conferences like today's. Part of it is the use of CDs to constantly get you out lots and lots of information that you can use as you see fit. Well, it sounds pretty amazing what we're doing here. The idea of having something on the low end and the high end, the idea of having it be open in the sense that hundreds of hardware manufacturers will continue to build these devices and compete with each other. We've seen the benefits of that hardware competition very dramatically in the last 6 months. A recent computer ad, not from Microsoft, talked about Windows and said, Windows is just software. In fact, they said it many times. It's only software, it's only software, it's only software. But we think that's a good thing. That was Microsoft's original vision, is that software would play a key role in building these new systems. And we hope that you agree that software will be the key element of innovation. Our goal in all of this is to make a tool that will be used by virtually everyone, whether it's in the office or in the home. We see the need to communicate, the need to browse information, the need to work together as requiring the power of the microprocessor and great software working together. The ultimate achievement of this vision is a machine quite different than what we have today, a machine where you don't have to think about applications or configuration files. And I can see our industry moving very rapidly to achieve this vision by the end of this decade. Thank you. One other thing I wanted to do today, before moving on to the other speakers, all of whom will be quite technical, is take the questions that were provided for us at the reception we had last night and go ahead and answer those. In fact, I think John Lazarus gathered them up and picked the ones that were of prime interest. Are you ready to ask the questions, John?
I've got the questions, Bill. We tried to eliminate as many of the duplicates as possible and reserve the more technical questions for some of the speakers who will be talking later today, tomorrow, and Wednesday. But I have some good ones for you, Bill. The first one's very respectful. Mr. Gates, will we be able to move from the NT 32-bit environment to the next 64-bit environment with a similar transition as we've done from Windows 3.1 to NT?
Well, two of the chips that NT will be supporting out of the first three are chips that have 64-bit addressing capability. And we're going to make sure that the transition to 64-bit is very straightforward, although we see the demand for that being relatively limited in the next few years. One of the things to recognize is that the transition from 16-bit to 32-bit is one where you're going from a segmented memory architecture to a linear memory architecture. Likewise, you're moving from an unprotected environment to a protected and secure environment. And so the move from 32 to 64, when it is necessary, won't involve nearly as many changes. In fact, things like Windows handles, Windows coordinate space won't need to change. It'll just be the memory pointers. And so that can be an almost trivial transition for people who want the large address space.
Bill, how would you assess the market for the MIPS 4000 versus the Intel P5?
Well, one of our goals in making Windows be portable technology was to open things up to innovation being done on all different microprocessors, whether it's microprocessors aimed at specialized markets or microprocessors aimed at the general market. And so all of these chips will compete on the basis of what kind of price performance they can offer. In our case, we're distributing software more and more on compact disk and electronically. And that makes it very easy for us to have different types of binaries for these architectures be easily available. Now, having said that, I do expect that the Intel-based processors will continue to have the vast majority of the market for the foreseeable future. But we are excited about our work with MIPS. We're excited about the work on Alpha. And we will be providing an openness to other chip architectures as well.
When can we expect a C environment which truly reflects Windows? When will the debugger and working environment be as good as Borland's?
I think the language tool market is very competitive. Certainly our group up at headquarters is very excited about the product they have out now and feels it's the best C++ environment. They will be coming out with a major new release later this year that's fully integrated into the Windows environment, including Windows-based PWB and Windows-based debugging. So I think Microsoft will have a strong role there, as will many other developers who write tools, a lot of whom are here in our trade show area.
Bill, you'll note that all these cards are bent or folded. This is because they do not fit through the slot of the Ask Bill question box. Is this typical of the level of intention to implementing issues?
No, I don't think so. I guess we wanted people to be really serious about getting their questions to me, so we made it fold.
Bill, will you work with Fortune 500 corporations any differently than shrink-wrap developer houses? What kind of support can we expect and technical assistance?
Well, what we've noticed over the last few years as we have started to work closely with corporate developers is that their needs span an even larger spectrum than commercial developers. Some corporate developers are a lot like commercial developers. They want the latest operating system releases. They want to use C++ and our foundation class libraries. And so we'll take everything we do for commercial developers, as we are in this conference here, and make it available to commercial developers. But corporate developers. Now, many of those people will not need to have that depth of knowledge. In fact, I think it's very exciting to see tools like ESOL or COBOL enhanced for graphical environments or Power Builder. Many tools that hide a lot of the complexities of the system and let corporate developers build their applications very quickly. And so through our field sales group that has hundreds of systems engineers, we're willing to sit down with corporate developers and help them pick the right tools and make sure they're investing their scarce development resources in exactly the right way. We do have a number of special programs that we will be outlining, including things like Microsoft Consulting that are aimed at corporate developers.
Mr. Gates, I once heard you say that OS 2 1.x was the future. I think I was there too, Bill. Can we assume a similar amount of commitment for Windows NT?
Now, when we worked on OS2, we had two strategies. We had our Windows strategy and our OS2 strategy. And in a way, that felt very safe because we had, you know, big IBM behind the OS2 strategy, and we had sort of a bottoms-up enthusiasm phenomena behind the Windows product. But we came to the realization that we needed to get on one strategy, that the kind of sharing and the kind of quality we wanted would force us to take a single approach. And so Microsoft is betting its entire future on this Windows approach. As somebody might say, we have all of our wood behind one arrow. And so we're doing our best work here, and we're driving it based on the needs of PC developers and PC users. So certainly our commitment is even stronger, particularly having learned the lessons of OS2.
Mr. Gates, should I really abandon VMS on my data center machines for a 2,000-plus node network of mostly PCs? Will NT really cut the mustard on Alpha?
Well, we're sure that NT is going to be a great product on Alpha. In terms of your specific situation as to what things you require from that VAX machines, the VAX machine, and how that relates to the PCs on your network, it'd be important to understand the particular requirements. Certainly the two things can be complementary. As you roll more and more PCs out to people's desktops, you can give them graphical access to all the information back on the VAX machine. The biggest decision is as you're developing new applications, do you write them in the NT environment or the VMS environment? And we do see over time more and more people shifting their effort to build in the NT environment.
Bill, what is Microsoft's policy for NLS, especially for local versions for Asian markets, such as Japan, Korea, and China?
There's two things we're doing with Windows NT to address the worldwide markets. First is that we are doing the work to have versions for every language, over 20 different languages that we support with Windows today. And we'll have those out within 6 months of the main Windows release. But even more importantly is we've now built in this feature called Unicode, and there's a special breakout session to talk about that. And it means that both Microsoft and applications developers will be able to ship a single binary that will work worldwide, as long as they provide the string tables that at runtime are matched into their executable. You won't have to have all these different versions like is necessary today. And end users as well will be able to exchange documents on a worldwide basis.
So, Bill, is your 959 federalized yet?
You told me you got rid of that one.
You may have to explain that.
Oh, that's just a car that is in a free trade zone in Oakland because it can't be brought into the country. And no, I haven't had any time to get that through the red tape yet.
Bill, what is Microsoft going to do to ensure its competitiveness in the workstation arena against such leaders as Sun and Next? Why would my potential users select NT?
Well, I think one of our key goals there is to have far more applications available than any other platform, whether it be high-end or any type of platform. And a major part of that is the relationship with developers that we're kicking off here today. We also feel that by having so many hardware manufacturers providing machines based on NT and the uniformity of applications compatibility, that we will move into the mainstream, even in some of the niche markets where PCs haven't been popular to date. So far, Unix-based platforms, the most popular, sells at about 1% the volume level of the PC market as a whole. And when I look at where they've been strong, I do see an opportunity for us both to grow the market and to move into those areas.
This question asks, our corporation is moving to Lotus Notes. What is Microsoft's commitment to groupware? Will it interface with SQL databases?
The key element of our strategy that you'll hear from Paul Moritz in the next presentation is to have work group capabilities built right into the operating system. And that means that individual applications won't have to define security, messaging, directory. There'll be a standard set of applications interfaces that reach out to all the various directory and messaging systems that will become available. As part of that, we'll take the mail capability and build it right into the shell. And so as we're getting things like replication and the rich object-oriented file system, you will see a lot of those capabilities that have been sold separately now just available as a platform where people could do specific applications, for example, applications that focus on a particular vertical market. And so between our system software work and some specific application work, we do see ourselves providing not only a work group set of capabilities, but a set of capabilities that is programmable and customizable to a particular company's needs.
Bill, when will NT go beyond baseline POSIX and support more recent interoperable standards such as XOpen or OSF? Specifically, how do you plan to integrate X-Windows and X-Toolkit as both clients and servers?
Our current approach is to simply ship NT with the POSIX capability and rely on a number of third parties to provide the full suite of software to give it XPG3 compliance and X-Windows servers and clients. For example, we have Digital Equipment is one of the companies that's building an excellent X-based product on top of NT. If we see substantial customer demand amongst the NT base, we can take any one of those and bundle it into the standard product. But certainly all of those things will be available.
Bill, does Microsoft intend to make its applications, Excel, Word for Windows, etc., available on the MIPS R4000 platform? And if so, in what time frame?
Well, I hope everybody has a chance to get over to our hands-on room where we have literally hundreds of machines running Windows NT. You'll see that one of the applications there for both the Intel and MIPS platform is Excel running in full 32-bit mode. And the experience we had in moving that from today's Windows up to 32-bit was that it was very straightforward. We've had over 50 people come into what we call our porting lab and have that same kind of experience. So Microsoft will be taking its high-end applications, first starting with Excel and then following with the rest, and making them available in forms that fully exploit NT.
This question has a couple of parts, Bill. What support do you anticipate for other CPU chips, the Intel 860, etc.? How difficult is it for manufacturers to license what they need to adopt to these chips?
Today, our focus is on getting NT out and on the chip architectures that we've committed to, specifically the Intel and the MIPS, and providing lots of support to DEC in their efforts to bring it up on the Alpha platform. Now, subsequent to getting the product out, we will be providing a very straightforward way for people who want to come in and get the portable technology and take it and put it on a new chip architecture. We will make that very straightforward. Now, what that means in terms of will it be brought over to the Spark platform, will it be brought over to PA or things like that, we're not really sure. It would really depend on either customers who buy those platforms or the companies who are involved with them seeing that as a benefit to them and wanting to get involved in pulling it across. I do expect over time, one way or another, it to be available on all of the popular chip architectures.
Bill, do you think that the Microsoft-IBM conflict has had an adverse effect on the U.S. economy?
Well, I think competition has always been a great thing for the U.S. economy. Certainly the microprocessor industry has done extremely well here in the U.S. The PC software industry is the most export-oriented, U.S.-centric business that I'm aware of. It's amazing that of the top 10 PC software companies worldwide, all of them are based in the United States. And so the move towards the personal computer as a tool to be used broadly in a number of firms, I think has had nothing but a positive effects. And although this rapid shift in computing performance has forced IBM to downsize, I think freeing up those resources and trying to adjust their business strategy has been a great thing. And so I expect more benefits from the areas where the two companies are in competition, as well as the areas where we continue to cooperate.
If I write a Win32 API application that uses RPC and multiple threads, will I be able to sell it into the DOS world at some future date? We must identify the real lowest common denominator APIs to minimize development costs. Is Win32s the end for DOS and Windows, or is it just a transition?
Win32s gives you a rich set of capabilities to write 32-bit applications. Of course, there are some things that are in Win32 that are not in Win32s, and we are hard at work on a major new version of DOS that would eliminate a reasonable percentage of those. On some of those, like Threads, you can go ahead and put it into your application, and it runs just fine on Win32s, even though it's not being executed in a threaded fashion. As we move up and continue to enhance DOS in what I think will be some pretty amazing ways, more and more of that full Win32 set will appear down on the low-end platform.
Bill, what is Microsoft's direction in the area of telephony support in Windows? Several applications exist which allow control of telephone features and calls, incorporating directories, call logging, and voicemail. Will Microsoft support any standardized phone control APIs in the future?
Well, this general area of taking the PC and thinking through how it should be integrated in the office and the home environment with other devices, I think is one of the most fascinating things going on right now. We've been working not only with PBX manufacturers and the regional phone companies, but also with people who make copiers and printers, with people who make fax machines, with people who provide video conferencing and voicemail, and coming up with a number of additional APIs that will allow any Windows applications to get out at that functionality. For example, pulling together the idea of the PC network directory and the directory that the PBX understands. Pulling together the idea of security so that when a fax comes in, no matter what format it's in, it can be distributed out and only made available to the right people. Also taking fax and providing a rich editable file format, as well as the current G3 bitmap graphics capability. So I think all of those things, when pulled together with the move towards flat screen PCs and voice type input, handwriting type input, will transform the PC in the office environment very dramatically. In terms of that specific question, it'll be late this year that we'll have our first open design review. That's a process we've come up with to get input from lots and lots of people as we extend Windows. We'll have an open design review that'll take a look at these phone connection applications interfaces and make sure that we've done that the right way so that those two things can come together.
Bill, 5 years from today, what will be the market penetration of Windows NT?
Well, it's hard to predict things like this. I think it's fair to say that 5 years from now, a typical PC would have easily 64 megabytes of RAM storage. And so it's hard to imagine that NT won't be the mainstream product. Of course, even NT will have evolved beyond that. You're going to hear in this conference, I think it's Wednesday afternoon, from Jim Alchin, talking about Windows futures that include the major work we're doing to have an object-oriented storage system and a lot of object-oriented extensions to the APIs and the user interface. And we expect those things sometime during 1994. And so 5 years from now, NT will have evolved very substantially, but I expect it'll be the mainstream of the Windows family. Now, having said that, it's still amazing to me the resilience that DOS has. We came up with a very simple product last year, which was called the DOS Retail Upgrade. We sold over $100 million of that product alone. And so I'm not sure that DOS will go away, but I think NT will be the mainstream.
Bill, what do you think about Bob Cringely's book, Accidental Empires?
Well, I don't know. I wouldn't want to make him mad. He could get worse. It is sort of a random number phenomena there. For example, there's something in there about my going to a 7-Eleven. I've never been in a 7-Eleven. I've never clipped a coupon out of a newspaper. I was tempted to go to 7-Eleven and find out if they take coupons, because I really wonder if they do. But anyway, there's a lot of stories in there that are kind of strange. What can I say?
I guess you figured out it's more fun down here asking the question, up here asking the questions, than it is downstairs answering them. The next question is, Mr. Gates, our company will be participating this month at the WOSA Financial Services Executive Meeting. What is Microsoft's plan concerning support our company as we build new classes of applications in the banking sector?
Another way that we're broadening the reach of the Windows environment is by going into particular industry segments and trying to understand what extensions, standardized extensions, would be valuable for the developers in that area. The first of those was banking, and we announced 2 months ago an initiative with the number of the systems companies like NCR and DEC to standardize some additional applications interfaces for things like automatic teller machines, check readers, and the transitions from the protocols that have been used in that industry to date. The goal is to have a lot of advanced development kits that make writing either retail or commercial banking applications very straightforward. You will see us taking that approach and extending it into other industries, including things like retail will probably be another focus. The part of the financial world that needs real-time quote data will be another area of focus. Having announced those APIs and that kind of extension, we then train many of the people in our consulting group on the specifics of that industry, and we make sure we know about the resources that our hardware partners have in order to help build those applications. And so we see Windows moving out and playing a big role in what to date have been fairly vertical segments.
Bill, Visual Basic is a great tool for prototyping, but programs created with it run much too slow. Is there a plan for a true compiler for VB to fix this? And what are the plans for VB on Windows NT?
I've always believed there's a role both for compiled languages like C and C++, as well as very interpretive dynamic languages like BASIC. Now, both of these need to be improved very substantially. Even in the C environment, as you modify your source code, we should be incremental enough that you're up and running and you can test that code very quickly. In the BASIC environment, we need to bring in advanced object-oriented extensions and things like automatic memory management and allow the BASIC programmer full access to the system's capabilities. We will be speeding up Visual Basic very substantially in a release that comes out this year. It's not through the use of the compiler. It's simply by tuning what's there, particularly in the areas of forms and graphics. Subsequently, we will come out with a compiler for that language, and we are working on a version that's specific to NT and fully supports its capabilities. So you'll see us continuing the thrust of substantial enhancements to Visual Basic. In fact, that's destined in a version that comes out later called Object Basic to be the macro language that's integrated into all of our applications, as well as continuing to enhance the C language to make it easy to write applications.
Mr. Gates, could you give us your definition of open systems and then describe how Windows NT will compete with or complement the open systems market?
Well, there are a lot of definitions of the term open systems. For Microsoft, what the term means is that we feel customers respond to having choice, choice and competition. And so providing them the widest range of hardware choices and application software choices, we think, is what furthers their business interests best. Part of that is providing great development tools so that on top of that hardware platform, they can write wonderful applications. And it has been very strange up till now that if you wanted to do something that's very high-end, you had to move out of the mainstream, out of the PC environment where the hardware and packaged software choices are so great, and pick up another environment. We really see the Windows NT product as eliminating that dilemma, giving people the best of both worlds, the kind of openness that the PC has had, along with the kind of power that those high-end systems have had. So we see Windows, particularly as we've made it easy to migrate Unix applications over, as participating in the open systems phenomenon. We do expect that many forms of Unix will continue to sell, and we have a goal of tying those in, both from a networking point of view, from a development point of view, and even some work to have some application availability on some of those platforms. So it's a major phenomenon and certainly a positive direction for open systems.
This next question came as a flowchart. Bill, do you read the Wall Street Journal? If so, have you seen the recent advertisements attacking Windows? If so, would you tell us how you really feel?
Well, Microsoft has always supported the Mac platform and felt that it had some excellent things to offer. The recent series of ads that Apple's come up with that talk about Windows suggest that they're not really up to date with what's going on in the PC world. For example, running an ad a few weeks ago that says it costs $3,000 to upgrade your hardware to run Windows. We can buy a whole new 486 PC with 8 meg, 200 meg hard drive for substantially less than that. And from a benchmark point of view, that's a machine that would outperform anything that Apple has to offer in its product lines. So although there's virtues on both sides of this equation, I think they didn't do a very good job exploring the virtues that come on the PC side, particularly related to software integration. The vast majority of Windows customers are not people upgrading their machines. We tackled that with Windows 3.0 and got millions of people to upgrade. But the phenomena today is a phenomena about new users. And as I said earlier, over 50% of the machines being sold today have Windows pre-installed and are using our Windows Ready to Run logo. So I'm unemotional about it, but I don't see the ads as being strictly factual.
Bill, what is your prediction for the future of Unix?
Well, there's a lot of great work that's gone on, particularly in universities, using Unix as a foundation and coming up with new extensions. We want to participate in that as well and come up with a way for the NT source code to be available to research groups, particularly in universities, so that they can work with that. We have seen the mock operating system at Carnegie Mellon really take a fresh look at rewriting the kernel, taking a lot of the code that's been in Unix over many, many years and that companies like Microsoft and Sun have contributed their part to, and by starting from scratch, doing a system that is very nice and very clean. And so I think from a technology point of view, a lot of great work is going on in this Unix environment. We do see it as something to connect our systems to. We do see ourselves continuing to track standards in the Unix area like POSIX or XPG to make sure NT is a great platform for those. And we see our biggest role here is taking developers who have worked strictly on Unix because of their high-end requirements and giving them such a large volume opportunity that they can expand their company sales in a dramatic way.
With the adversarial relationship between Microsoft and IBM, how confident can we be in Microsoft's ability to maintain its SNA engine? And how much are you cooperating with IBM on developing connectivity solutions in the future?
Well, our relationship with IBM has many aspects, and the parts where there is great cooperation between the two companies doesn't get as much press as the competition we have with their OS2 group. We have worked with both the AS400 group and the mainframe group to make sure Windows systems can tie in. That's a goal they have, and it's something that will help drive demand for their systems if the integration is done in the right way. It's also important to point out that there's a lot of third parties who do a great job of providing connectivity into these larger IBM systems. It's safe to say that the SNA connectivity in the Windows environment is far superior to any other environment. There's at least three or four companies who've done a great job and keep pushing that forward. Several of those are in our breakout areas and already showing how they're going to take Windows NT and connect it up to these larger systems. And so we do have great cooperation with IBM on those issues, and we think that's valuable for both companies.
Bill, this last question is one that I've also been wanting the answer to. Bill, what can you say about the rumors that you're going to join forces and run with Ross Perot?
Well, I was back in Washington, D.C. last week, and I don't think any of the jobs back there are all that great. Certainly compared to being part of this industry and having an opportunity to drive things forward. So it's not within my vision to ever enter the political realm.
Thanks, Bill.
Thanks.
Hi. We hope you found the information in this video valuable. Before we leave, we'd like to give you a quick look at Microsoft University and some of MSU's other services. As part of Microsoft's Education and Consulting Services Group, MSU provides technical training straight from the source of the world's most powerful software systems. You get the knowledge you need to have an immediate impact on your productivity and your bottom line. Microsoft University provides a broad range of courses geared for different audiences at various skill levels. MSU courses are always timely and based on the latest versions of Microsoft software. The courses currently offered cover these products: Microsoft University offers a library of video courses, like this one, for support professionals, as well as a separate library for programmers and developers. This self-paced training option offers many benefits, especially the ability to leverage your training investment. Microsoft University provides hands-on lab-based training at 10 regional facilities in the U.S. and Canada. Students are removed from office distractions and can focus fully on their learning experience in our state-of-the-art classrooms. If you're looking for a cost-effective way to train more than 10 people, check out our on-site courses. Microsoft University will bring the instructor, student materials, and expertise to your location. Another way to take courses closer to home is through the Microsoft University Training Alliance program. Members meet exceedingly high standards. Their instructors are trained by MSU, and courses are identical to those offered at MSU locations. Unique training needs are often best met by a custom course, solutions-oriented training tailored to your company's needs. Custom courses can be taught by MSU instructors or licensed for delivery by your own internal training organization. Finally, to help corporate decision makers understand the rapid evolution of today's technology and how they can apply it, MSU has developed a special series of high-level executive seminars on tour in major cities across the country. That's a quick overview of one of the most powerful training resources in the microcomputer industry, Microsoft University, dedicated to not only what the industry is today, but to what it can become.